From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we'll feature two films showing as part of the Milwaukee Film Festival, which closes today.
First, the featured subject of the documentary, Stumped, explains why he decided to share his story.
In the abstract, what was happening to me was interesting as a story. And I just wish it weren't really happening to me, you know, as a person, as a human being going through this suffering was terrible.
Later, another film explores street murals and graffiti and whether they're art or nuisance.
There are certain artists who will do their artwork uninvited, but then the recipient of that artwork is delighted beyond belief. So was it really a crime or was it a gift?
And harpsichordist Jory Vinicourt performs and talks about a Friday concert featuring music from the court of Marie Antoinette. Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. 6 years ago, Will Lotzenheiser was starting a job teaching film at Montana State University when he started to feel a pain in his leg. After his first two classes, he went to the hospital where he went into total organ failure. In a matter of days, a strep infection had caused Will to lose his arms and legs. This is where the documentary Stumped begins.
Stumped was the opening night spotlight feature at this year's Milwaukee Film Festival, which comes to a close today. Stumped first appeared at the festival as a short film a few years ago, but the filmmakers decided to create a full-length documentary after Will was cleared for arm transplants.
Lake Effect's Joy Power sat down with Will and his partner Angel Gonzalez, along with director Robin Berghaus. Will explains why he decided to share his story, first as a news piece and then as a full-length documentary.
In the abstract, what was happening to me was interesting as a story, and I just wish it weren't really happening to me, you know, as a person, as a human being going through this suffering was terrible. But narratively, I knew as a filmmaker that it could be a really powerful story, powerful film. And of course, I didn't myself really have the resources to pull it together as a film. Well, before it was a film, it was really an article in the Boston University Alumni Magazine. So that was already a choice about whether I wanted to be public with the story or not. And I had been involved with the Boston University community for so long, I thought, well, a lot of those people probably should know what had happened to me. So that was a decision that I thought, you know, okay. But even to be public about it or to be more public about it, we had to go through a process of deciding, you know, could the story help people? Could being open with the story, I don't want to use the word inspirational, but could it just help people go through some of the struggles that everyone goes through? You know, it doesn't help to be isolated in your struggles sometimes. Sometimes it's better to be open about it. So we agreed to do the story, and as part of that, we agreed to make a video. And Robin was the person who was assigned to make a news video, essentially to accompany the written story. And Robin asked, and we decided to accept that we would sort of just keep filming. So it turned from one news story to two news stories that were separated by a few months or a couple months of very intense rehab. And you can even see within these two videos the difference between when she spoke with me in March of 2012 and when she spoke with me in May and June of 2012. And then we just continued, and those were turned into, well, expanded into a short film. And then I was given the approval for the arm transplants, and that really grew into the feature. So it was a very organic process. And I think at all points we thought maybe this can help other people going through the same types of things or even different types of things. It's not just about amputation. And we also felt that it was important to talk about organ donation and to be open about that experience, to try to just increase awareness that organ donation is a thing that can transform people's lives in extraordinary ways.
Angel, you were so much a part of this story. When the filming started, did you imagine yourself as being as much of a character as you became?
I think with the short, I pulled away from it and didn't necessarily want to be a part of it because it was more about Will. But as the full feature started to come along, Will and Robin, I guess, decided it would be important for me to be part of it, and I agreed. So as difficult as it was to have a camera there while I was busy trying to take care of Will, I had to kind of say this is essential for it, and I hope it made an impact.
Were there moments, and this is kind of a question for all of you, but were there moments where you both said, like, I can't do this right now with you? And were there moments for you where you felt invasive, where you felt like maybe I shouldn't be here?
I don't think so. And well, I also just want to thank Will and Angel because it's very generous to share your story publicly. And so I always wanted to respect their privacy. And we had conversations about scheduling and, you know, just getting through each and every day is tough. It's exhausting for both of them. And so I know at times we would schedule to make sure that I was there during the week, but they wanted their weekends off. So, you know, logistically, I really wanted to respect that. And then in terms of the moments where, you know, I would talk to Will about wanting to share his triumphs and but also vulnerability, and he was very open to that. And so, you know, we found ways to set up filming so that it would be respectful of his privacy, but also share those moments that are very personal and that are impactful.
I want to add that, I mean, within the documentary, you know, you see my scars. I'm basically naked in the shower. And we thought, you know, not that I feel like I'm an exhibitionist in any way, but that this needed to be shown because people get scars and it's part of my experience and it's part of many people's experiences. And it just felt like it was necessary for people to see that. And the need for the movie to have that visualized was more important than my whatever qualms I might have about showing off all my scars.
I didn't feel that my privacy was pushed to the limit because we could always just say no and that was that. So I think we did good.
That's good.
I don't know. Did we ever say no?
I think just if you were tired, I wanted to make sure that you had a break. And there were a couple of nights where you guys are just exhausted. I'm like, let me just take off and we'll figure out another time to get that material, or I would do it on another trip.
Yeah.
You know, because it's a struggle. I mean, each and every day you guys work so hard just to perform daily tasks. And so I wanted to respect that.
One of the things I found maybe most interesting about the film that for whatever reason I wasn't expecting was just kind of the basic information about transplants, about kind of the process that entails. What did you learn in this experience that I'm guessing you didn't know before about transplants?
I only knew the most general layman's information about transplantation. And I guess throughout the whole process, I had to absorb quite a bit about some of the real specifics of it, including what the drugs were doing to me and, you know, what elements of the transplant need to be controlled and how the transplant really affects the way I can live my life, because so many things are, I don't know, fraught with potential causes of danger when one is immunosuppressed. I don't know.
I mean, there was that the first time you learned you couldn't eat chocolate, and it was like, wait a minute, why didn't you tell me this before the arms?
Very early on after surgery, I wasn't allowed to have chocolate for a brief time. And the way my surgeon told me was making it sound as if I couldn't eat chocolate in perpetuity after the transplant. And that was a very frightening thought because I love chocolate.
Understandable. That would be rough.
I was like, what? Why didn't you tell me?
Why did that come up?
I really said that. Why didn't you tell me I couldn't eat chocolate? But it was just because chocolate is a
vasal constrictor of sorts.
Yeah. It can do things to your vessels, the caffeine essentially. So you essentially don't want anything messing up your vessels when they've just recently been attached to other vessels. Anyway, I had to learn a lot about transplantation pretty quickly. A lot of it I learned over the course of a year while we were exploring whether this would actually be a good fit for me. It took a year of testing to establish that. And then, of course, you can learn all you want about it in an academic sense, but then when it actually happened, then after that, you begin to realize some of what this stuff actually means experientially, and that's quite different. And it's been fascinating and beautiful in so many ways.
Going back to the transplant process, there's this moment where you're rushing to the hospital and, you know, we see kind of what you're seeing as you rush to the hospital. And it's this really hectic moment. And, you know, I think as someone who's in the audience watching it, you think to yourself, how can you be holding a camera? How is that, like, possible? How is it possible you're thinking about this right now?
So I wasn't there on the day of Will's surgery, so I recreated that. And so it was essentially, my thought was, I knew that I wouldn't be there because you can't plan a surgery like this. You know, someone sadly passes away and donates their organs, but I live in Texas, and, you know, Will and Angel and his family and doctors are in Boston. So I had constructed in my mind a way to get around that, and that was to do some filming from outside of a car, shots of the city leading up to the hospital, and the last shot was going to be backing up in front of an ambulance. So you get the idea, and with the sound design, that they're on their way. But the footage that shows Will on the day was filmed by Steve, right? His friend Steve, his comedy partner and personal care assistant and friend. And so we had talked a little bit about what kind of footage they could film on the day when I wasn't there, in order for us to piece together that part of the story.
We actually went in a different door.
Oh.
So, I mean, it's like, that's not the door I went into when I, that's the, you know, emergency entrance, and we went in the front.
In reality.
You know, I think the importance, the truth of the feeling is there, and that's the most important thing.
Brigham and Women's had some of the film crew there to...
Yeah, so on the day of the shoot, the hospital, Brigham Women's Hospital, they have videographers that they hire to film their surgeries, and those videographers are trained in HIPAA laws. There are certain hospital regulations for privacy, and so they had their videographer film the surgery on that day, and so the hospital donated the footage, and I was able to use the footage to edit it to incorporate within the film.
Oh, interesting. What was it like for you watching that, watching your surgery, where you obviously were there but don't remember it?
In a way, it's shocking, and in a way, it's beautiful. I don't think I'll ever be used to watching surgical video the way doctors might be able to know that the cuts that are being made into my arms. And then the moment that's especially incredible to me is when the donor arms are brought in, actually being carried in, and you realize as a viewer what's in the cooler, essentially. And then you see, as Matthew Carty, one of my surgeons, says in the movie, you see during the surgery a kind of white cadaveric color of the hand, and then you see the hand pink up as the vessels are joined to my blood system. And when it pinks up, you know that that hand is living in a way again still. And it's incredible.
What is it like for you watching that?
It's just sort of surreal. I kind of take myself outside of my own thoughts and just experience it from sort of an audience. So it sort of just makes me think of when I first saw the hands. And when I first walked into the ICU to see Will after the surgery. And it was like, wow, those are beautiful hands. That's sort of a constant reminder. Whenever I see how many times I've seen that movie already.
Well, and that's another question I had in watching the film. Of course, it's different being an audience member, but there are moments that are very intimate and that are very difficult to watch, but it's your lives playing out on screen. Do you find yourself having different reactions to it every time? Do you see it differently now than you did when you first started watching it?
Yes, I think we've both gotten accustomed to listening to the audience reactions because we want to see if they, how they react to certain moments in the film, and every audience has been different. So it's kind of fun, I think, in a way, for me at least.
That's been enjoyable, yes. More enjoyable than me realizing that I say like too many times in some scenes and other glitches that really make me cringe. I don't think it's ever easy to watch yourself perform or watch yourself on screen blown up into a huge, you know, huge projection. It amplifies all your quirks and speech patterns and errors and all this in a way that might not be totally wonderful. But I think for the most part, audiences aren't going to be looking for that. It's only that we've seen it now many times. I think, oh, I wish I didn't say like twice there, things like that, minor nitpicky things.
Now, I don't want to give too much away of the film, but you use a lot of audio from WBUR, of course, and Here and Now. And one of the final things that we hear is a conversation that was, at this point, about a year ago with Robin Young, where you were contemplating a leg transplant. And you mention, of course, that similarly to the arm transplants, it comes with a number of risks. Is that something that you're still thinking about?
I am still thinking about the leg transplants. However, subsequent to the interview that I had with Robin Young, I've learned that I have some issues with my hips. Something called avascular necrosis is developing in both hips. This is probably the result of my sepsis initially back several years ago now, 6 years ago. So in a way, sepsis is the gift that keeps on giving even when you really don't want it to give anything anymore because it actually just takes stuff away. But in order to fix that, I would need hip replacements probably, and to think about load bearing through donor legs while I'm either recovering from hip replacements or still would need them after that. We're talking about a lot of surgery, and I've had so much surgery, I really have to think carefully about whether I want to endure all of that. And I'm tending to think possibly the answer is no, but I still have, sometime soon I'll be talking with yet another orthopedic surgeon about what some options might be.
Will Lautenheiser is a comedian and the featured subject of Stumped. He was joined in studio by his partner and fellow subject, Angel Gonzalez, and director Robin Berghaus. They spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and for more information, you can head to WUWM.com.
Another film screening later today at the Milwaukee Film Festival looks at the blurred lines between street art and public art. We'll explore those lines when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. There's graffiti or unsanctioned street art, and then there's public art. Sometimes the lines are blurred. Sometimes it's very clear which is which. But as cities around the country try to reduce vandalism, they are enlisting artists to create spaces that not only replace the blight, but also engage the communities they're in.
Sarah DeLeiden runs MKELAX, a cultural exchange initiative between LA and Milwaukee. And she's a producer for the documentary Civic Art, Four Stories from South Los Angeles that's showing as part of the Milwaukee Film Festival.
She and Stacey Williams-Ung, muralist with The Wallpapered City and program director for Black Cat Alley on Milwaukee's East Side, joined Lake Effect's Mayon Silver to discuss the role of public art in cities like Los Angeles and Milwaukee. And they start by explaining the spectrum of art and markings found in public spaces.
I always like to define it along a spectrum, where the one extreme spectrum of graffiti is vandalism. And on the other extreme with public art, it might be a $5 million marble statue, you know, commissioned by the city government for the park square. And then there's a huge amount of gray area in between. The easiest distinction to make, I think, between street art or mural art or even public art and quote-unquote graffiti is the criminal aspect. I mean, the simplest sort of on-off switch is, was it by invitation or was it vandalism? So that's kind of the easiest way to say it's one thing or another, but there's certainly a spectrum. I mean, there are certain artists who will do their artwork uninvited, but then the recipient of that artwork is delighted beyond belief. So was it really a crime or was it a gift? And then there are some very, very talented artists who do beautiful work on a building where they're not invited and the building owner is outraged even though the community loves it. So it's not always a black and white issue.
I think Stacey's analysis is actually really useful. I think it's very complicated. And I also think there's times when it's, I think of it as sanctioned and unsanctioned, you know, whether I've gone through a formal permitting process, which could be because it's commissioned and actually funded either from a government source or a private source. But I think there's many times, and I've done a lot with performance as well, where I might just be in a public space, a park, a sidewalk, and it might be more blurry whether it's actually considered to be sanctioned or not. So I think that's the tricky thing about the word graffiti. I also think we use the term a lot to describe an aesthetic that's come out of a lot of the street culture for many decades, urban street culture particularly. So I think it's just, it depends so much on what the site is, what the context is, what the relationships are. But in the end, to me, I'm just mostly interested in how to bring art experiences to where people are already living and working. And I have a particular focus on public spaces because I just believe it's really important that we use public spaces and feel like we co-own them together.
Well, that's the thing. What do these graffiti works, if it is graffiti versus an installation, what does it bring to the community or not bring? Or, I mean, there's so many gray areas, but what is the hope that an art piece will bring to a community that's sanctioned?
Well, I think what any number of art pieces can do, again, depend, wherever they are stemming from and whatever their permission level is that art has an ability to actually bring voice, you know, to a person, to a group of people, to a neighborhood, to the experiences that are there. So it's a storytelling avenue, really. And I just think it's a really valuable part of being alive is being able to see our stories around us and that artists are just one of the kind of neighbors that can actually really help to make those stories be visible.
And so this film, Civic Art, Four Stories of South LA, showcases four different artists or art projects. Can you tell me a little bit about the different artists and their locations in LA?
So the project grew out of the Los Angeles County Arts Commission. They got a grant through the Open Space Program in Los Angeles County. And the goal of the program was to come up with a creative form of graffiti abatement because the county is spending millions of dollars every year repainting their neutral blank walls that have no windows that have graffiti marks of all different kinds that can show up anytime during the course of the year. And so it was an experiment again within the county government to try to see if making an art investment might affect literally how much other graffiti incidents happened at the sites. But also really at the core of it was just using art to invest in the public spaces as a place that people in the neighborhood use. They were all well-used public spaces, two parks and two libraries in South Los Angeles County. And how that could actually become, how could the new artworks we put in be an expression of that place and the use that already was there as well as the use that could be there. But one other layer that ended up being really important with these four sites, these four different neighborhoods and four public spaces inside of them, was that I did an initial site analysis of each of the sites and from there worked with the county staff to actually decide artist teams to work with each of the sites over the course of a number of years. And one of the things that I discovered really early on was that South Los Angeles actually has a broad range of cultural groups in it now. A lot of the neighborhoods are historically black neighborhoods, and there's still a considerable black population in the neighborhood. But there's also a lot of Latina families now. There's different Asian American immigrant groups. So it was very broad. And so we really looked at how the art projects could talk about cultural exchange in the U.S., you know, so how we actually have to spend more time communicating, listening, just connecting with each other, because it's very easy for any cultural group to stay with itself and not necessarily be curious about who else is right next to them even.
And what were some of the ways that you were able to get these cultural groups or the people actually living in the locations involved in the projects?
Great question. That was the heart of what the project was about, was doing different experiments of socially as well as physically at each of the site as a as an effort towards graffiti abatement, but again, as just an effort of exploring what civic art could mean. So one example I really love, we worked with a collective called Cocina Abierta, run by Cristina Sanchez, an artist I had worked with in the past for a number of years I really love. And she and her team, what they figured out is they identified 5 different community chefs in the neighborhood. And each of them, the chefs, again, was a different cultural group. And they each had a role at the park already. So one was a softball coach, one was ran the Zumba classes. So we ended up doing video profiles of them because we had decided that we were going to activate the community kitchen that was in the – there's a community room and kitchen that was right in the center of this large recreational park. Victoria Park is the name of it. And so the chefs each took turns cooking a dish from their family inside the community kitchen, and we recorded this, just made professional cooking show videos. But we also made a profile video of them out in the park doing what they do. And another layer of it then was we regathered all of these community chefs and their networks, their families and other friends that came, also many who used the park already. We gathered them together and we screened these videos. Everyone came for a potluck meal.
There were some talkbacks with people that were living in the communities and people giving ideas and, you know, communication about what they wanted in the space, right?
Yeah, and again, it was us gathering these different neighborhood leaders who all used the park together to have a meal together always. It's like frequently about having food together, but then also talking about what they would like to see and what they valued about the park itself as well as their role there.
Well, and right here in Milwaukee on the east side, there's Black Cat Alley, and that was an installation of public art that happened in 2014, right?
Well, it began in 2014, and then the big installation to reveal it to the public was in 2016, where all the artists sort of had a crash installation all at once, almost exactly a year ago in September of 16. And then we did a smaller installation plus a green space in this fall, in September.
Well, and one of the things that you see in the movie Civic Art is that there's so much work that goes into the installation, the conceptualizing of the project, the actual getting okays from people, the bureaucracy, and then the putting it together. Did you feel that in Black Cat Alley as well?
Well, we wanted Black Cat Alley to be a 2014 project, so if that answers your question. You know, we started off with fairly modest goals, like let's get some students to paint this alley. This alley is gross. It was as simple as that, as the nugget of an idea. But then those of us who were planning it had experience with other public art projects and muraling, and it just kind of started to have these broader aspirations of what can this really mean for this community, for this neighborhood. We have this opportunity here to have a lot of artwork in a small space. And I'm really inspired by what Sarah was talking about because we also wanted to make it be more than just murals. How can we have performances here? I mean, we've had swing dancing events there, dinners in the alley. And, you know, this was an alley that was full of garbage. The city back in the 80s, I've heard, don't know if this is true, had a sign up that said rape zone. You know, I've heard just horror stories about this alley, and it, you know, has had homeless encampments and so on. So we've gone from something that was a real scourge on the community, on what was otherwise a really lovely neighborhood, to something that's now like a tourist, an official tourist destination in the city of Milwaukee. And that's really magical to see that transformation happen and to see people bringing school children to a place where formerly grown men wouldn't even go. It's just been really great.
Have you found that in the spaces in Los Angeles that were showcased in the film, that it's had a transformation?
Yeah, I mean, we were working with, again, public spaces that already had a pretty strong use. It's part of what was actually quite touching to me about the sites. And right where the artworks were placed weren't always necessarily right on the wall where the graffiti might have happened previously on the site. A lot of times I think the art can be a flashlight in some ways. It can just show what's there and whether that can be something that people don't want to see or they do want to see. Like, that's all part of the package. And I also think that the art can just start to open up imagination about what's possible. So a lot of times, even if it's a space that's, you know, it can be a space that's really in decay, like Stacy's talking about, which I've dealt with many times also. But sometimes it's just a space that's nondescript and it's not thought about much. And so it's like how to reinvigorate those. And for me, it's also always about the government itself. I mean, I'm very interested in local government, how to support the government to become stronger. And so I feel like a lot of these art investments, both the physical and the social investments, can just help neighbors relate to their government particular government staff workers and politicians, but also to the government as an entity that technically in a democracy we all co-produce. So it's just humanizing the government in a lot of ways, too.
That's exactly right here in Milwaukee, too. The Department of Neighborhood Services took note with Black Hat Alley and other similar projects, and they really are trying to understand how to use these art projects to invest in different areas of Milwaukee. Another thing that was so nice about Black Hat Alley, over and above the impact it had on just, you know, ordinary citizens like you and me and just enjoying it, was that other neighborhoods took note. So Bayview, for example, became interested, and we did a project in Bayview with much more highly used spaces. And Sarah's right, it's so different analyzing the project for something that's a place that's in decay that you're trying to draw attention to in a positive way versus a busy city roadway like Kinnickinnick, and then putting five new murals by women artists all along KK. How does that change KK? How does it change Bayview? How does it improve Bayview? And what does it say about the neighborhood? Now West Allis is interested. Now Lindsay Heights is interested. And as we take these different neighborhoods with different demographics and different goals, you can't just say it's a one-size-fits-all, like, yep, no problem, we'll go find you five artists and we'll paint five new pictures and everything will, you know, be different. You have to really analyze, what is your goal with this project? What are you trying to say about your neighborhood? What are you trying to say to your neighborhood by doing this project? And do you want to invite artists from outside for positive reasons because it exposes the community to new art and new voices? Or do you want to celebrate artists from your neighborhood, which is also positive, to say, let's leave a legacy of the people who lived here? So there's so many different and beautiful things that you can do that are all just different flavors of how, like Sarah said, the government of that community or the organizers of that community, even if they're not like official government, how do they create that dialogue with the people who live there every day?
From the artist's perspective, you were talking about, you know, whether to bring people in from the outside, whether to have people that are homegrown in the community. But in the film, there was one of the artists, I think his name was Fausto Fernandez. He said of finishing his project, it feels like a breakup at the end. You work on it for a year, then it stops, and everyone goes on to the next project. So my question for you, Stacey, about Black Hat Alley is, does it feel that way for you as well? And how do you continue the public engagement with the project after you're finished creating it?
Well, Black Hat Alley, our vision for it all along has been that it would change and be like a public art gallery. That was our best analogy for what it should be versus just being set in stone. And traditionally, street art, at least in our community, especially in historically Black and Latino communities with legacy murals, the mural is meant to be a legacy and to last as long as possible. You look at, you know, Reynaldo Hernandez's mural that got redone after 25 or 30 years because everyone still loved it and still wanted it there on North Avenue. That's a very different kind of mural than, say, Adam Stoner's mural in Black Hat Alley, or even Tia Richardson's or anyone else's, because those are more contemporary murals that speak to something that's happening with us right now. So maybe they'll feel a little tired in 2020. Wouldn't it be more exciting to paint over them and have new paintings that surprise us and delight us and make us want to come back to Black Hat Alley the way you would visit your favorite art gallery and say, what do they have up now? Because I just think that's what's going to keep it more vibrant. I also think programming with more 3D work, with more installation work, with light work, things that people don't expect, dancers, anything. In a way, the content of it almost doesn't matter. It's almost incidental. It's about creating experiences and stories that make Milwaukeeans want and visitors want to come back to that space repeatedly.
Would you agree, Sarah? What is that you're trying to accomplish with the works of art and people driving by or people walking by?
So we have a very complicated current practice and history with where art exists in our culture. And the point is there's still a lot of art experiences that are put into very specific spaces like museums. There also are a lot of art experiences, again, formal and informal ones that are happening at sidewalk level. But to me, again, I'm really interested in how to encourage further production along those lines. And also for me, it's a lot about encouraging a certain kind of artist that actually wants to work with the people around them as subjects, sometimes as co-producers physically. You know, that I think this is about a kind of art making as well as what the actual works are that are finished in the end. And all of this to me is just about a way to have what I would call civic engagement happen. Like whatever sector you're coming from in terms of a professional sector, whatever geography you're coming from in the neighborhood or in the city, or just whatever your cultural identities associations are. And I really love what Stacey's saying about, you know, I too, while I'm making things that are permanent, they're going to last usually for minimum 5 years and often many, many years. It's also about how to keep a certain life to that and a feeling of change. So sometimes I just think our stories and having our stories visible, it's part of what helps us both appreciate where we're at, but also change and know what we can become and start working towards that.
That's so cool. Well, thank you so much, Stacey and Sarah, for coming and speaking about it, for your projects, and I wish you luck in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sarah DeLeiden is producer of the documentary Civic Art, Four Stories from South Los Angeles. Stacey Williams-Ung is a muralist with Wallpapered City and program director for Black Cat Alley on Milwaukee's East Side. They spoke with Mayan Silver.
Civic Art, Four Stories from South Los Angeles shows at the Milwaukee Film Festival this afternoon at 5 at the Time Cinema.
Next on the show, a performance by and conversation with Chicago-based harpsichordist Jory Vinegar, whose Great Lakes Baroque Ensemble opens its third season in Fox Point tomorrow. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
We're back with Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Tomorrow evening, the Milwaukee/Chicago-based Great Lakes Baroque Ensemble opens its third season with a program that focuses on the music of the late French Baroque period. Music for the Last Queen showcases French composers of the late 18th century, just prior to the French Revolution.
Ensemble founder and harpsichordist Jory Vinegar met me and our recording engineer Jason Reavy just north of Milwaukee. Jory, it is so great to see you again. Thank you so much for having us up here.
Bonnie, I'm so delighted to see you. And when you say up here, we are speaking of the home of my incredible and unique friend, Brian Gore, over in Grafton, Wisconsin. And in his beautiful orangerie, we see lemon trees and all sorts of wonderful
things. Even though
things
it's
here.
A gray kind of chilly fall yes. day, it is lovely and warm in here. And there are two harpsichords in yes. here that he built.
Mr. Gore, who is a very, very well-known and well-respected architect and landscape architect, built harpsichords way back in the day. We have two concert instruments in this orangerie and two other instruments that he built elsewhere on the property.
Well, what is the concert that is going to happen this weekend?
This is a very, very special event, and Philippe Leroy, who, along with me, is the artistic mind, if you want to call it that, behind Great Lakes Baroque, long wanted to explore the music that happened at the very end of the last real regime, the music under Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette, and he calls the program Music for the Last Queen. And this is not accidental, although I think many Americans imagine Marie Antoinette as only being extraordinary, frivolous, or associating her with the phrase, let them eat cake, which is probably, it was never said and is quoted out of context even when it is said. Marie Antoinette was very, very cultivated. And upon her arrival to the French court in 1770, she immediately became very passionate about music. She was already a bit trained. She studied several instruments herself, harpsichord, the fortepiano. She played the harp very decently as well, and sang, and composed. So a real music lover. We know that under her reign, certain composers who remain famous today, like Christoph Willibald Gluck, were much supported by her. So his successes at the Paris Opera can be partially ascribed to Marie Antoinette. But she also had a number of other composers, fascinating individuals, who are mostly neglected and forgotten today. Even in France. And Philippe, instead of concentrating on composers who haven't been entirely abandoned, Gluck being foremost among these, he wanted to explore great composers, and they are great composers, who are too much forgotten, and unjustly so.
So musically, what was happening in Europe at this time? In 1770, when Marie Antoinette came to Paris, that was kind of a shift in music,
It is a shift. Because if we're thinking of the greatest period of French music, and in my very biased fashion, as I'm, of course, principally a harpsichordist, I tend to associate this with the harpsichord players. So if we were to look at Louis XIV's reign, it would be very difficult not to speak of François Couperin, who we call Le Grand, the Great. And François Couperin wrote 27 very important suites for harpsichord, some of these very, very long. And that is actually much more keyboard music than was published by Bach himself, for instance. Couperin gave way, if you will, to Jean-Philippe Rameau. They overlapped. Rameau died in 1763 or 4. And was mostly composing opera and orchestra works at the end. So if we achieve a kind of acme of complexity and very, very ornamental music, what had to happen next was a return to classicism, thus the classical period. Things become simpler, more melodic. And yet at the same time, the French insist upon remaining French. And so many of these composers, while giving us more accessible melodic things, can't resist the ornamental style or very, very daring harmonic modulations.
As we're talking about this, I'm thinking, is this what we would call Rococo in architecture? That kind of lots of ornamentation?
I think that is not an unfair thing. And of course, I remind myself, I remind our listeners, that there is no clearly defined cutoff in any period. We do occasionally say that the beginning of the Baroque period in music is Italian opera in about 1600, almost precisely. That gives us a very, very clear guideline for the beginning of Baroque music. The end of Baroque, beginning of classicism, well, what can I say? These overlap terribly. Rococo, we're looking at style over substance to a large extent. And I don't think that would be entirely unfair to claim that about much of the music of the period. And yet it would be so unfair to just throw it all into the same box under that heading.
And just say it's nothing but frill and...
Exactly. Yeah. And there is a lot of it. And Philippe points out that of certain composers, many of the pieces are very frilly. And then at times, the composers will nonetheless want to explore more, want to show off their real art and not just to entertain.
We're sitting in front of this beautiful instrument that you're going to play a full piece on in just a moment, but I'm hoping you can give me maybe some examples of, we're talking about ornamentation, what it might sound like a Couperin-style ornamentation versus a later, what the differences might sound like.
Of course, right under the gun.
no pressure at all.
none whatsoever. So if I were to play a few measures of what I can recall right off the top of my head, say of François Couperin's Les Amusements, the amusements, from his seventh order, we're going to have a melody filled. Every note has something. So etc. That was more or less it. But we can hear that very simple melody. That's it. But Couperin gives us an ornament on just about every single note. So that is one aspect of French music, and Couperin can occasionally choose to exaggerate that for expressive or colorful reasons.
And did Rameau do similar types of things?
And Rameau, for instance, one of the more beautiful solo pieces of Rameau, L'Entretien des Muses, the meeting of the muses. We can hear mixed into that beautiful texture a number of little trills, mordants, so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm. And that brings us to the piece we are going to hear in full. This takes us from Couperin through Rameau to...
This kind of last gasp of French harpsichord music. So Philippe has introduced me to a composer who had the rather amusing name of Simon, which would be Simon. He was a music master at the court of Louis XV and what we would call intendant de musique, if I'm not mistaken, pour les enfants de France. So les enfants de France is referring basically to the crown prince, princess, all the royal, not only children, enfants, but any royal family members. So he would have been the main music teacher to the court. He remained very much in favor with Marie Antoinette. We know that she had various scores of his in her personal little bookshelf. So we're not speaking of her major library. I mean, very near to her own instrument. She kept these near and dear to her heart. Something that has only occurred to us very recently was that Simon probably had something resembling a sense of humor about his double name, and many of his pieces carry repeated syllables. So what I'm going to play today, the proper noun would be Arard, A-R-R-A-R-D. Who is a person? We don't know who this is referring to, but when you say the name completely, it's La-La-Rare, so La-La. Another concerto, La Fon. So this is deliberate. Other composers would very studiously avoid repeated syllables. So he seemed to take this as a little bit of a joke. The piece, however, is not jokey at all. It's a rather passionate piece. So not quite as fluffy, if you will, as many other pieces of this time. And for the music lovers out there, listen to the influence of Jean-Philippe Rameau on this. So very theatrical, very brilliant, still incorporating a bit of this very ornamented style, but just a bit. And I would also ask everybody to listen to how far from our home key of G minor, how far Simon is willing to go. We end up in A flat minor at a time. And again, for music students, music lovers, remember that in the Baroque time where we don't have a perfectly equal temperament, despite the well-tempered clavier of Bach, this is another story, we are still treating A flat minor as something which would be very strange indeed, and how to get there is quite a journey.
Thank you.
The Great Lakes Baroque.
This is year three.
And how has it been going?
So it's been, you know, a very interesting process. I think like all small arts organizations, there's a learning curve. Things are changing, becoming interesting. We have, among other extraordinary projects, we have a collaboration with Florentine Opera, thanks to director William Florescu. I will be conducting John Blow's Venus and Adonis alongside Purcell's immortal Dido and Aeneas at the end of January at the Marcus Center. And this is a collaboration with Great Lakes Baroque. So for the first time in Florentine's history, we have a period instrument band, that's to say players specialized in Baroque, violin, cello, theorbo, myself leading from the harpsichord. So of course, Great Lakes Baroque is pretty darn thrilled.
Drury, it is always such a pleasure to see you.
Oh, Bonnie, for me as well.
Pleasure to hear you play. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for coming over here. And thank you, Jason, our engineer.
Great Lakes Baroque will perform Music for the Last Queen tomorrow evening at the North Shore Congregational Church in Fox Point. Harpsichordist Jory Vinaker founded the ensemble and will be among the performers.
Special thanks to engineer Jason Reavy for the field recording and to architect Brian Gore for hosting us and for the use of his harpsichord. There are photos from our session at WUWM.com. And that wraps up the show today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned.